2 over. Beginning of channel 2 over. Continuation of Mr. Nealon at the kitchen table on the visit of the Audubon group on Saturday 11th of October 69. Beginning of channel 2 over. Continuation of Mr. Nealon at the kitchen table. Visit of the Audubon group on Saturday the 11th of October 69.
So, when I started the 4-H club work, well, one of the old fellas, he saw me with a bunch of boys, you know, and he says, look at him. He's lost out, I guess, with the old folks. Now he's fooling around with the boys. See, they didn't understand. My big trouble was that I didn't understand, but they didn't understand.
Oh, yeah.
But when his grandson, the apple of his eye, won a trip to Washington free, all of a sudden 4-H club work worked pretty good.
Oh, really?
So yeah. It takes a while. If you're pioneering, you have to take it in the neck for a while.
Yeah.
Anything. It doesn't matter what it is. So, in one way or another like that, why you get yourself established. But I got into forestry because, well, I had a terrible time. I don't know whether I told you about this before, but the border, the Bunnell, the county seat ring was just as crooked as it could be. Terrible. And I didn't play ball, so they were against me. I didn't join.
That's the courthouse crowd. Right?
Yeah, the courthouse crowd. Well, two members were from the country, but the three controlling votes were real estate men selling the Yankee worthless land. And now and then new settler would come in there and say, I was thinking about buying this piece of land. We had a 36,000 acres of good flatwoods land in the county. You want to sell him a worthless piece of a hard pan and miserable that he didn't know. So I'd say, no, don't buy that. Well, fire the county agents. He's a stumbling block to progress. And they'd fire me. But by that time, the farmers said, no, you don't. And they filled up the courthouse and said, you put him right back. And,
What do you mean, filled up the courthouse, Mr. Neal?
Well, it was a standing room only in the commissioner's courtroom. I went around. It was a funny thing. That wasn't the first time they fired me, but you finally get a little experience, so I went around to each one of them, and I said, looks like the boys got a little radical at the last meeting. Yeah, they did, he said. And I said, well, I always thought you were in favor of the work. Well, I was, but the boys would have it so. And I said to each one, well, I'm glad you're in favor of the work. Maybe sometime you could put in a word for me, you would. Oh, I'd be glad to. He's just glad I didn't browbeat him, you know. So I went around to the other four, and every one of them said exactly the same thing, and every one of them I told the same thing. Maybe you put in a good word for me if you get a chance someday. And they said, oh, yes, we'd be glad to. They didn't have anything personally against me. So then I went around to the farmers and I said, well, they fired me.
They did nothing personal. They just fired you to get rid of it.
It interfered with business. Well, I went around to the farmers and the farmers, I said, well, they fired me again the last meeting. Of course, they notified me on the 12th of the month that my service had been discontinued on the 1st. Well, I never quit work. I just kept on working. And so I went around the farmer and I said, they fired me again. I just got my notice. Is that all right by you? No, it ain't all right by me. Well, I said, the board meets again on the 22nd. And maybe you could express your views on that. Be there. And a bunch of farmers filled up that commissioner's courtroom, and they were in no good humor because they lost a half day's work coming to town.
Yeah.
And so.
In the middle of the week.
Yeah, but the funny part of it was, my superior in Gainesville came down that morning and met with the county commissioners, and I went with him and had nothing to say, of course. And he never asked any questions. He's an old classmate of mine. So he was district agent, and the chairman says, looks like we got a man from Gainesville here. Maybe we better hear from him. And Slayton got up and said, yes, on the Representative Pension Service in Gainesville. I understand you discontinued County Agent work here, and the chairman said, yes, we have. Well, Clayton said that's all right. Just want to know how to arrange our budget in Gainesville because of the cooperative pay thing. And sat down. Nobody ever asked why. I think they wanted me to get me out of there. In fact, they offered me a better county. So I stayed on there until the Depression came in. And I was conducting my abandoned State Forest Service, came in late 28. And I was conducting my 4-H work, and the State Forester was a new man from Montana. He didn't know Florida. The timber or the pine, didn't know one pine from another, naturally, and he got acquainted. And he heard about my work down there, but the county paid me $60, and the state and federal was $60. Out of that, I had to pay, buy a car and run it all day long, because I didn't need an office, and not a paved road in the county. It was rough going, breaking springs all the time and all that. So when they hadn't paid me for 5 months, I hated to let the farmers down. They'd been loyal, and I had a lot of unfinished business there. You know, that's a continuing program, so I didn't quit. But I finally told the wife, oh, it has to be something. You can't support a family on $60 a month, even if you have a cow and some chickens on the farm. So by that time, the State Forester came down to visit me, and he said, if you're that much interested, you should be working for us. Well, it was pretty hard to refuse, so he gave me a beginning job and paid me a much better salary, and all travel was paid for by the state. So I had the mean job, and I had to do supervisory work and fire line plowing. We had farm equipment in the woods, which was always breaking down. 13 tractors from West Florida to St. Augustine. I had try to get the repairs made and go to the next place. I hardly ever got to bed before 10, 11 o'clock or through work or driving. So after that, then they promoted me and I was district forester. But the profession is very tight there. I'm not a qualified man.
Oh, yeah.
Qualified man.
Well, now, you were district forester?
Yeah, with the State Forest Service.
Well, then, that's pretty high up, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good job they passed. Mr. Baker, he saw that I was trying to do my way in the woods, and he passed up some regular graduates, and that created an awful backseat.
Oh, it did.
To promote me ahead of them.
Yeah.
So I worked with him, but I originated some new ideas, and particularly a multiple use program in 1930, which would give us successful fire protection at a profit, not at a cost, that is, the landowner. Get successful fire protection at a profit instead of taxing the taxpayer for $6 million every year to protect his farm. And I hold it wrong for government to do for people what they can, should, and will do better for themselves. I wouldn't want the government to come in here and run your farm for you. Why should they come in and take over the forest land and tell a man what to do? A hired man is never as much interested in anything as you are. The owner is, I mean. And so he wouldn't be as capable or as efficient. So then I worked with them, and then came along this other thing. I got home at 10 o'clock from a field trip one time, and the director, I don't know if you ever get acquainted with Dr. Newell. He's director of the experiment station and extension at the time. And he called me up at 10 o'clock and he said, we need you. I want to recommend you for a new job. It was during the Depression and land use planning was coming in. And they wanted someone to be land use planner for Florida that had both experience in agriculture and in forestry.
Oh.
I'd worked with the State Forest about 6 years then. So I said, well, how long does that job last? Well, he said, I don't know. It's only guaranteed for 6 months, but it will probably go longer. Well, I said, I like what I'm doing. What'll happen to me then? Well, he said, you don't need to worry. You'll always have a place to land. So That paid me more than the State Forest Service paid, and it was a much more responsible job. I had to travel every road and trail in every county in the state to make a reconnaissance land use plan map for Florida, and it was a challenging job. And so I worked at that until it played out 3.5 years, then they disbanded that work. And then Dr. Newell called me back to the Extension Forester for Florida, and I knew the state pretty well by that time. And I have eyes to see what I'm looking at, so I got acquainted pretty well with the soils and their future use. But when I was with the State Forest Service, I started the multiple use program project. And I outlined it all and made carbon copies and sent it to Tallahassee. Never heard a word. His assistant got it, immediately pigeonholed it. So about 3 or 4 months later, the State Forester wrote me and he said, what are we going to do to stop this terrible fire problem? Because everybody burned the woods for spite, if not for any other reason, because they didn't like the State Forest Service. Interfered with their cattle business. And so I said, well, I sent you my suggestions 3 months ago when it was. He made them dig it right up. And he was for that. It was a multiple use program with wide, 100-foot wide pasture strips surrounding blocks of timber and with consideration for wildlife and honey production and other values in the forest. Well, scorn and ridicule, except for Mr. Baker. He said, you boys let Neelan alone. He's working on something. So as soon as I went with land use planning, they plowed up all my wide fire lines that I had to protect the barriers right away. A forester, well, you know about cows. Disgusted, you know. Well, a fellow's got no more than one thing if he's going to serve Florida. But the funny thing is, today, multiple use timber grazing and game is the program. We have now a good program.
Mr. Neelan, but when you got up there with the brass, you see, then you, that's not very interesting. That's just desk work.
Well, the trouble is, Plains Forestry knew nothing about cows and brass and grazing or wildlife in those days. They didn't study anything like that. So in the deep south, that program has been adopted now.
But you had more fun when you was getting fired by the courthouse gang.
Well, I had a lot of fun there because these new graduates were qualified men. They never let me know that I wasn't qualified. Now, he's a qualified man. One time I asked one of those qualified men, he wanted to know how far a certain distance was, and there were some pine trees over there, young pine trees, and I said, oh, about as far from here to that slash pine, and I said, which is the slash pine? And that's our principal forest tree in Florida, and he didn't know it, qualified man.
But you've had a lot of experience with the courthouse gang.
Oh, yes, I've had plenty down there. One time, it turned out better than usual. I had an old professor at Gainesville in the early student days, and while I was working here as farm foreman, he wrote me, he said, my nephew has been approached in Ohio to buy a piece of land in York County and by a salesman, and he said, gave me the name of the concern. I didn't think much of the company because it was kind of a fly-by-nighter, and I saw that. More than one had tried that in that county. So I wrote him, and the first thing I said, this is a confidential letter. But I don't think that concern is very dependable. They are new and just starting to sell land here, and the land in question is good land, but it is not well enough drained for farming. You may lose your crop in 1 year out of three quite readily by high water. Oh, no, he sent, he should have known better than that. He sent that letter up to his nephew. His nephew gave it to the salesman. the salesman wrote a letter and enclosed that to the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners and said, this is the kind of the sales resistance we're meeting in your county. It was an Ohio concern. They're represented.
Oh, it was Ohio concern?
Yeah. So I met with the county commissioners usually once a month to see if they had any instructions. They never did. But I happened to be sitting here, and the chairman was sitting there.
Yeah.
And that time, for some reason or other, the chairman of the board was a farmer who lived right close to that area where they were promoting sales on the land.
Yeah.
And so he sort of understood my problem, I think, because he passed that letter under the table to me, and he said, read this, and whispered, read this, and I held my lap on the way to see it, and I read it. I was astounded to think that someone had sent that up there and come back. If it had gone to the real estate chairman, I'd been fired right on the spot. But this old farmer, after I read it, I slipped it back under the table, and I said, throw it in the waste paper basket. He said, that's what I thought. Never heard anymore.
Well, now, all those fellas, was there some pretty nice fellas amongst some old farmers that you worked with?
Oh, I enjoyed them no end. Of course, there were some that were not. See, we had...
You had some that was a pill, isn't that
right? Yes, unfortunately, we did.
Yeah.
See, when I went to work there, after the hogs were all vaccinated, I wrote to Gainesville, the chief there, and extension was new in those days, and I said, what are a county agent's duties? I got a letter right back promptly, and to the point, it says, put your finger on the most important thing and go to work. I guess it's up to me, I said. Look around a little. So I said, why are all these potato farmers losing their farms? Every once in a while, some old farmers.
Yes. What about that?
Why is that? Well, I started looking into it. And they were mostly financed by the banker, the real estate man, or the abstractor, or the merchant in town. They were financing them.
Yeah.
And they gave him $5 an acre also for living costs. Mule feed and things like that. So I figured out after that, you know, those farmers are paying 40% on 90-day money when you figure all the deducts, $15 a ton added to the market cost of fertilizer, all such things, seeds. $5 a sack when the seed could cost them only $4 a bag, and so on. They just charge. Well, I said, why are such high rates needed? Oh, it's a hazardous business, I said. Well, I was hazardous to the farmer. He stood in to lose his farm because they collected the farm if he couldn't pay. And then they could sell it and make money. So I said, well, the only thing I can see is organize a co-op. Hastings was just organizing their potato co-op where the farmers...
Well, now, these fellas, Mr. Nealon, who was doing that? Tell me about some of them fellas that was in on that.
That were doing it? Well, yeah. They were legitimate. They were people in town. That was all good business. Banker, he did a lot of it.
Yeah.
In Bunnell. He financed a good many.
Yeah.
And... So I organized that co-op because at first I had no luck. I drove to every bank that invited me.
Well, that was just a system then.
Yeah, that was a system.
And what happened was that the little old farmer held the bag all the time.
Yeah, he always held the bag. He had nothing to say about anything. He just, either his crop paid back, and if it didn't, why, they'd take the farm. And at those costs, nobody run a business on 40% money. When you figure out what the costs are of operating, so I couldn't get any bank would agree to lend farmers anything on any kind of agricultural paper. I didn't know. I'm not an economist. But I bought me a book, Bank Credit and Agriculture, which someone had written. Thought maybe I'd get some hints out of that, but it didn't. I didn't give you that time to read it much. But anyway, a bank opened up in Crescent City, a new bank. The old banker was about going out, so he must have had a lot of confidence in me because he lent me $25,000 on my note and the farmer's note.
Oh, for the co-op?
For the co-op. Out of that, I bought for cash, and cash paid in those days. When you get $15 a ton less for fertilizer and same for insecticides and feed and containers, barrels, we shipped in barrels in those days, and dust and buy for cash, you save. Operation costs for me were $30 an acre less than the fellow across the fence who wasn't in the co-op. Then I was in charge of financing, field supervisor, general manager, marketing agent. I said to the boys, you fellows put up a U.S. number one grade and I can guarantee you 50 cents a package above the market. Oh, sure, we'll do that. Some of them did. Those who did, why, they came out fine because 40 barrels an average crop, 20 dollars an acre, you see, potatoes would sell for, we'll say, $5 a barrel. Mine would bring $5.50. So you add that on 40 barrels to the acre average crop, you would get 20 more dollars than the fellow across the fence would get. So my farmer on 10 acres, little 10 acre farmer, would get on a poor price year, get to take home $500. The fellow across the fence had nothing. And the farmers liked it. Of course.
Well, now, what did they have to do to get them grade one potatoes?
U.S. number one, just be honest enough not to put the twos in with the ones. They wouldn't do it. And then I would watch those graders until they couldn't run the chain so fast the twos went in with the ones and then want to get the U.S. number one grade prizes. Number ones are the big potatoes, number twos are the smaller ones. Well, then I watched them so close they couldn't get away with it and they got hopping mad. You wouldn't like it yourself if you had to put up with what you make us do. I said, all right, I'll plant me 6 acres. And I did. Then I hired 5 of the biggest kickers to watch my grader. And I paid them $3 a day, which was good wages in those days, to grade them the way I said I wanted them to grade them. And every potato that had a blemish on it didn't go in. And I said, here's a barrel for the with a sunscald spot on it if he pushed himself out of the ground, a green spot. Or a rake, we hoed everything with potato rakes. You harvest the crop with rakes then, and the niggers often were careless and would rake one and scratch it badly. All the damaged potatoes, put them in that barrel. I use them for cow feed and hog feed. All right. First half hour or so, whenever they found one that had an injury, thrown in the barrel, they threw it away as far as they could. Just to show their spleen, you know. But then afterward, that was got to be tiresome, so then they threw them in the barrel. I never said a word. So you see, you don't always have perfect specimens to work with either. And then we had other things that would show where the president and the vice president were too mean. They were both northern people, Yankees. And
by Yankees, you mean they'd been down here just a short time?
Yeah, recently. And most of the people were old Florida people there, but they were newcomers there. But they were more intelligent, so they got to be elected president and vice president. So one time we had to haul our stuff over miserable roads, 10 miles, our supplies from Bunnell. And I knew that Miller, who at Crescent City had a barge line between Jacksonville and Palatka and Crescent City. And I said, Bill, I used to play baseball with him in the early days. And I said, how about you hauling our tonnage down from Jacksonville? We not only got a better rate, freight rate that way, but the potatoes were within 4 or 5 miles instead of 10 miles of where the farmers were. They would be delivered there. So I told him what arrangement I'd made. Oh, yeah, do that. Okay. But Bill Miller said, well, but I can't haul them all. You have too many. It'll take two loads of my two big barges to get all that stuff delivered, fertilizer and seed. So I explained that to him. I said, well, it won't hurt us to come. It'll be a week later with the other lot, but you can make your beginning with what seed and fertilizer you get, and by the time you get through with that, you'll have the others. You know, that was perfectly all right with everybody. Okay. And I put a man, when they came, put a man down on the docks at St. John's Park on Crescent Lake there to see with a list of how many potatoes and how much fertilizer each one was to get off that barge. And he was checking them all. And two of them, the president and vice president, after the meeting, I went to my Model T. We met in a little old schoolhouse there, in the country schoolhouse. And I went, and everything was dark. I went to my car, and here those two showed up out of the dark. And the president said, I want all my stuff on that first barge. And the vice president says, and mine too, mind you. I said, look here, boys. Just because you're president and vice president, the rest of the members are not going to like that. That wouldn't be according to the agreement. And they never said another word, but went back, so I thought I had convinced them. No, sir. That night they hauled everything they had first. Well, we took that up in the membership, and they were suspended at the end of the year.
Oh.
Suspended from membership. Then they got really furious. Then we fired them forever. But you see, you have dishonesty creeping and self in you. Another time, I couldn't get any help. Oh, man, you need a lot of help to dig them out. And the rainy season was threatening. We need to get those potatoes. I worried a lot more than the farmers did because I was responsible for that $25,000. So, I said, I drove everywhere looking for help. Finally, I saw a man in Bunnell, and he said, you know, I can get you help. He had two trucks, and he knew a lot of Negroes north into the county at a turpentine camp. He says, they don't have anything to do. There's a lot of teenagers and women and men there that I can get two truckloads of help, 60 people for you. But he said, I can't do all that without some pay, but I'll bring the help and take them home at night. Provided, in the meantime, they let me haul their potatoes 10 miles to market, to the siding, the railway, at the regular price of 5 cents a barrel, which everybody charged always. And I told them about that. Yeah, bring us that help. Okay. So, everything was going along all right, and we were getting our crop off the market. One time I was checking in and then go to the fields and then go back to Bunnell. All my expense, all that travel, of course. And check him in at the car, came back, and here came the man with an empty truck instead of loaded with barrel with potatoes in it. And I stopped him and I said, what's the matter? Well, he said, your men are not as good as their word. He says, they're now hauling, ganging up together, hauling their own potatoes and leaving me out. I said, turn around. I was furious. And I went out to the fields where two of them were loading their truck, and I said, get out of this field, you so-and-so. You promised that man that you were going to do that, and now you're not going to cheat him. Well, then they fired me out. And enough of them dishonest, and it was a rainy day and night, and that night they got all their men at the meeting and they voted me out. Well, that lasted just 1 year. And they went back to the bank, and the old banker said, who you got managing for you over there? Well, so-and-so, he's our secretary. We don't know him. We can't loan you any money. Didn't get any money. Then they had to go back to the old system. That cured them. I could have worked around and gotten the majority there, but it still had that hatred against me, you know. If I had won in the election to be old fella that was president, I insisted on him taking it. He could just read and write, but no more, but a fine old southern gentleman, and honest. And he said, well, he didn't want to take it, but I said, well, it's no go if you don't. So he took the job, and when they fired me, he said, now how are you going to get things done? You done fired our manager. Things manage themselves. We're organized now. We don't need any management. And so they went back to the old system. The next year, they called me down to the little schoolhouse again. Want you to manage for us again. Oh, no, I said, I couldn't please you fellas. You didn't like the way I did business. I don't think I have another thing to do with it. I was plenty busy as county agent anyway. Anything you say we'll do. I never saw a bunch of that same crowd more humble than they were. And so I managed for them another year. And then I said, look here, the county agent's got more to do than just how I'd heard over potato growers. We got lots of things we have to tend to, and I can get you a direct membership. We've got 1,000 acres of cooperative potatoes. Hastings has now gotten on their feet. They'll take you in. It'll cost you 2.5 per acre for the service after this, but you can well afford it when you're saving $30 and $40 and $50 an acre. Oh, he throwed us down. No, I said, throw you down, but that's business. And the fact of business is I had no business doing that in extension. I think the Gainesville office was nervous the whole time. I fear I'd have a terrible break up there. But we got along all right, as long as they stayed honest. He did a good business. I was up in New York on my vacation one time. I stopped at, we had a brand name, and I stopped at one of the principal potato buyers there. I had to go up about 10 stories in the building, and here he was sitting with a telephone in each hand, buying and selling potatoes. It was 20 minutes before he ever got quiet enough so he could ask him a question. I said, see, you got our brand name up on the wall. What do you think of those? Best potatoes we get from the South. And the trouble is, you won't let us have enough of them. Because we didn't want to glut the market. We got better distribution. So, I bet there are more than one economist in this country that wouldn't have been able to run that show for 3 years. And it was agricultural economics, and I never saw a book because they didn't teach it when I was a student. It was 4 or 5 years later before the university taught economics. But often economics has got to be mixed up with some practical horse sense and the ability to get along with people or not get along with them sometimes.
Now, you know, Mr. Neal, that's just phenomenal. You know, it's hard to do business with somebody after he cuts your throat or stomps your foot or something like that.
Yeah.
But you had to do that constantly.
I do it constantly. All the time.
You couldn't have any tender skin at all, could you? You just had to have tough skin.
Oh, yeah, to have tough skin, have understanding. Finally, you begin to learn a little about how people behave and not to expect too much.
And then you don't get
the ring and Bunnell was always against me until the end. You know, they were so crooked themselves, and I couldn't afford to get into crookedness. I'm not interested in a crooked dollar. I never have been. We were taught better. So finally, they said, never could catch on to Neelan's racket. He's getting his somewhere, but I can't figure out where he gets it. They thought I had a racket, you know. It never occurred to him somebody might be wanting to make an honest effort. That was foreign to them. So you live and you learn and you tough it out, but when they hadn't paid me for 5 months, I finally got my $300. I came back through, I had 12 Northeast Florida counties in my district. And came through Bunnell, and I said to the, I saw on the street there, on the curb, the clerk was standing there. I said, "Hi, Dale, how are things going?" "Oh," he says, "about the same as usual. By the way," he said, "there's a little money accumulated in the agricultural fund. Now maybe the county could pay you what it owes you." And I said, "Well, that's good news. Is the chairman in?" "Yeah, he's in. I saw him down the street a while ago." So I found him and got a voucher and walked off with $300.
Well, now, when did you pick up your bird study, Mr. Needle?
Oh, in the woods largely, but I was always interested in birds.
Just a little bit of time?
We grew in the wilderness, and one reason was birds were sometimes an enemy of our fruit crops. Other times, they were, larks would come in swarms of 100 or more and pull up your wheat or your oat grains when it was sprouting. But that wasn't the main reason. We boys lived in the wilderness, and there was nothing else to do. There was no moving picture. There was no way to town. It was horse and buggy days. So we decided we'd make a collection of eggs, a clutch of eggs of every bird that nested in our region. And we very closely accomplished that.
Now that's out west.
That was out west. I still have the collection fairly well intact. But when you move, a lot of times some of the eggs get broken. Then I gave away a number of them to the museum.
Well, now, these fellas that I hear, when they were growing up, what they talk about, you see, is going to a country frolic. And you see, they'll have a party up till midnight, and then they'll go out and do something else the rest of the night.
Probably some liquor mixed up with it, and maybe not too wholesome a party at that, is it?
Yeah.
What do they do till midnight?
But, and I never run across any of the ordinary people who live out in the countryside who know one bird from another.
No, that's true. Well, in following these birds...
And what they know is wrong.
Yeah, most likely, often it is. But then, I like... wild ducks. And mallards nested very, very rarely in our region. They all went north to nest. But I found one that nested along the creek under a tuft of grass. And so I got those eggs and hatched them under a hen. I always had a flock of wild mallards on the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then collecting the eggs, different kinds, the magpies, the crows, the field sparrows, the linnets, the orioles, the red-tailed hawk, the Cooper's hawk, and all of those had to be tracked down.
Yeah.
And we did that on Sunday because that's the only days we didn't work.
I don't know how you got into that, Mr. Neal. You didn't do that just because you didn't have any movement to go to.
Well, I guess I was interested in nature mainly. Hunting and fishing, the rifle and shotgun brought the meat. There were no butcher shops. Those were primitive times.
But look at these animals and know them and pursue them. That's you didn't have enough education to do that.
No.
I
never had any education.
Well, but you didn't have enough anything to do that. How did you ever happen to start doing that?
We called a field sparrow a gray bird.
Yeah.
And we called the other fellow Green Bird. Why? Because he laid little green speckled eggs in a special nest. And we named everything.
You just had your own name for
everything. The winter, the robins came down, and also the varied thrush came down along with the robins. He's almost as large as a robin, but different coloring. Well, we had no books. There were no books written about birds in those days. And the varied thrush was called an Arctic robin because it came along with the robins and was somewhat, had a little brownish on him also, but otherwise very different. So we named all the birds according to what notion.
I never do run across that much information. Let me tell you, one of the finest farmers I ever met and finest fellas, you know, Mr. Bryant out here, Mr. M.M. Bryant.
Well, didn't he die recently?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought a lot of that man.
Yes. You know, I was out there one time, and I don't remember now how it came up, but he said, no, these hawks bother him. He says he just shot a blue darter out there on the fence post, and I knew exactly what it was. It's one of the little Florida Jayhawks.
Well,
let me tell you, who just is gentle. A blue darter not going to come up and set on a fence post.
Well,
now why?
There's something funny about hawks.
He knows it's not funny about hawks, is Mr. Bryant.
Well,
now he knew about wild hogs,
and he
knew that strip of land he had out there. But he didn't know anything about birds.
Well, no.
Nothing.
I think Florida people are notoriously that way.
You can't get any further wrong than calling one of those gentle little Jayhawks a blue darter.
Well, there is a blue darter, and you may know him also. The little blue darter is a sharp-shinned hawk. The big blue darter is Cooper's hawk. And the little fella, then there is a pigeon hawk, which is a little, I only see him here in the winter months. Then there's this little tilly hawk, you know, he's most, they should call him grasshopper hawk, because that's his main food. He seldom bothers a bird. I saw one of them ruffle up with a blue jay with a butcher bird one time. The two of them fought it out. The butcher bird's got a mean crooked bill, too. And neither of them won. But I think the butcher bird got the worst of it. I was plowing a field down there in Florida, and he sat up on the limb in the tree all that afternoon. Didn't move. I think he was trying to recover from his scratches and injuries. But the little hawk didn't kill him. He just tackled him, and they fought it out and roughed it up. I think both of them were glad to get rid of each other.
They don't know about wildlife of any sort.
No, I found that out. The trouble is, they are not interested. They never have been interested. And if you're not interested, you won't learn anything.
They don't get the straight on things like Bahia.
No.
They think about Bahia as a coarse, sort of cheap grass. It comes in early, they think, and then it's nice. And then it gets tough the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Why, it's just beautiful grass right up for frost. If you manage it.
Yeah, of course. Well, they probably didn't know how to manage it, and one trouble with the old timers always is they were pretty well used to living off the land.
Yeah.
And they only learned what was must for existence and subsistence.
Well, now they could butcher a hog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they know how to do that. They know the necessary things. The absolute necessary things they know. And they have their fund of knowledge, but when it comes to learning something new, backwoods people are pretty difficult to get them to engage in something new. But they're no worse than
others. Mr. Bryant's not one backwoods.
No.
He's been up around
the
courthouse.
No, he's a smart fellow. He's a smart man.
But he had blind spots. Just huge. Blind. He had blind spots. Things he didn't even look at. But he didn't know. He didn't know anything about them.
No, that's right. He did have plenty of blind spots. Well, I do too. I guess we all have some, but nobody has a corner on all the knowledge. You just don't live long enough. But on the other hand, I belonged to, this Farm and Home Administration. And I'm one of the board of directors, which is mostly counseling that comes up. We don't meet more than about once or twice a year. And Bryant was on it too, and I always noticed he would come up with something. Proposition is under consideration. He usually had some common sense about it.
He was a fine talker.
Yeah, he was a good talker too. That was in his favor.
Yeah.
But I noticed.
He talked about interesting things.
What would they be? What interesting things?
All sorts of things. He would talk about raising tobacco.
Oh.
He could. I don't think he's very good at raising it. but he could talk about it. Oh, he was a great talker. Oh, yes, I just loved him talking.
Now, this is Channel 2 over. 575. Channel 2 over, 575. This Audubon visit with Mr. Neeland, Saturday, the 11th of October, 69. Oh, this is a long tape. I followed him clear to the back pasture and back with a little Sony around my shoulder. I told him I was taking long to tape the yellow warblers, but every time they saw me, I was right there with Mr. Neeland, so he must have been my yellow warbler. He came on in the house for 30 minutes and stayed a good bit longer than that. Towards the end, he was eating out of his chair, go home. He just talked out. And this is 585, 585 and 90, Channel 2, over Mr. Neeland's tape on the visit, Audubon visit, on Saturday, the 11th of October, 69. Now, this is the same day. This is a trip. I went out with him with my little Sony ear over my shoulder. Every time he talked, I'd stop and I'd tape. And we did that all the way out there to the back pasture. And various people would come up, and he'd talk them out. And Barbara stayed with me. She didn't miss a word. We came back through the west hammock, along the west side of the my swamp, and back up through the pasture where Cookie's animals are. And then all of them collected about that time, and I got him to stay another half hour or so to make the tape that precedes it. Now I'm transferring this cassette, and I'll make a few comments either before or after, where we were, what the occasion was. I haven't played the tape back, so I haven't studied it. It's also on Saturday, the 11th of October, 69, the Audubon visit. I should have let everybody talk in it, just hear their voices. Oh, that had been so nice. They were all in a good humor.
What did you call it, please?
This here?
Uh-huh.
Yes, bird meat.
Well, bird.
Yeah, birds eat the berries.
Oh, yeah.
Morning doves at my place, and they say the gentle dove, the mean as can be.
The morning doves?
Hack each other and chase each other off.
Got rid of all our cats. We got some cat food, and we put that rat poison in it, and they all died.
The doves?
Yeah. No, I mean the cats.
Oh, the cats.
The cats.
That got rid of them.
That got rid of them.
No, that's the only way.
Were they wild cats?
One was a...
Now, that's beautiful, isn't it, Mr.?
Pretty little thing.
A cat
that
is very famous. I mean, not the alley cat, but this
one. Let me tell you. Well, this is when I ran in. He and this German lady comes out every time. I forget her name. Lives out on the Archer Road. I thought he was looking at pokeberry and talking about all the berries on it, the birds eat. But he was talking about that little vine and said the birds ate those seed. And the German lady was talking about something else. The cats were hard on the birds, so she got rid of them. And yes, and Mr. Neeland had been talking about the mourning doves. That was so hard on each other. And she picked that up and told about the cats. As I remember, he poisoned some of those doves, and she poisoned some of the cats. I forget. And that little vine, I walked over to the big fig tree. That little vine was growing against the end of the old shed, as we call it, and asked him if that was the same vine that was growing up in the fig tree. I didn't find out, but he commented on that vine.
Be a pest. It never bloom, but it makes seeds like nobody's business.
Oh.
I know the
it's
name of it, but I can't think of it as usual.
That's
the worst time remembering names.
Well, if I let that go, you wouldn't have any figs here. It would just take the place in little no time. I don't know whether it'd take one season or not.
You mean if you let what go?
This stuff here.
No.
Maybe the name will come to me in a minute. I never can remember the name in time, but I know it well.
I don't know it, so I couldn't.
Native in our woods. Two kinds of it. One grows.
Now, what I do is get down underneath there on my knees and just pull the roots.
If you don't get the roots, you won't get it.
This summer. The wild grape had taken over our little, we have two empty lots in back of our cottage in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And the wild grape had taken over. Now, why? I never in the 20 years that we've been there before have noticed the wild grape until now. Now, the Dutch elm disease killed some elm. Now, would the dead trees start the grape growing, or is it just that I hadn't noticed?
Probably grapes just that I hadn't noticed. By the birds.
Yeah,
the seeds
I know, but, well, the chunks are just big around.
Well,
so I had to grow in and
dig them out by the roots. Cutting off doesn't do any good.
They'll start
right back.
I know, but it saves the trees until next summer. I couldn't possibly have dug them up.
Get rid of them as soon as you see them when they're young. Then you won't have a problem.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another thing. Is these oak trees, if you let that keep growing, let these little oak trees, now I've got several out there, let them keep growing until they get even half that big, you've got a problem just getting them out.
Oh, you do? Yeah. And the little fellow only about this high has got 3 feet of taproot.
Yeah.
And you better get it down a foot under the ground or it'll sprout again.
I know. We have some in our front yard. Yeah. My husband cut two down. And it looks like a lovely shrub. And there were two boys from England who were staying at our house this summer with my son. And they went out and did the yard work, and Bill looked out once, and here was one trimming this oak,
Oh, yeah.
He thought it was something choice.
the English like to round off.
Yeah.
You know,
McKinney? No, the time I was
standing
in
the same place. The lady.
The middle of the road.
I didn't know her. Talked to her, brought up the grape.
This horse.
We're standing right by the fig tree.
No, I know very little about it. My boys say the only time I know when there's something wrong with my car and stops in the middle of the road. About right.
They're supposed to run, aren't they?
They'll go around and tickle this and tickle that, and first thing you know, it's all right. But I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
We still got some stragglers back there.
Oh, have we?
It's reported here as having already counted 21 species.
Yeah.
I haven't been out in the woods. I haven't seen anything. Yeah. Lately, I stay too busy.
Oh, really?
Days are all too short.
On those trees?
Huh?
On your trees?
Partly on the trees, but in other ways, too. That hardwood planting is beginning to attract attention now.
What's it like?
It's swarmed and never heard of such a thing.
What kind of hardwoods can you grow in Florida?
Now?
Yeah. What attention is it attracting?
Huh?
What attention is it attracting?
Well, no one's ever done anything with hardwoods in Florida.
Yeah.
And everything you find out now is news.
Yeah.
And some of it's important.
Yeah.
Planted some cottonwoods 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Found some in West Florida. It's not native except west of Tallahassee. And planted a few. The professional, see, I'm not a professional forester. I've been in the woods so long they thought I might know something about it, so they called me in and made me do the work, which is work I would have done if I was 7 years old. If you had asked me what I wanted to be, I'd have told you I wanted to be a forester, but no forester training available.
Yeah.
So I just grew up
in the forest.
In the woods, and kept my eyes open, and there's something to see if you have eyes and recognize what you're looking at.
Yeah.
So now I made this planting. And cottonwoods are part of it because it goes down to moist land. And I told one of the state foresters, I was planting some cottonwoods. Cottonwoods, what are they good for? I'm not supposed to know anyhow, you know.
Well, what are they good for?
Yeah. Boy, I saw a list the other day that the Stoneville, Mississippi Hardwood Research, I didn't know it existed until 3 years ago. That's the most useful wood, and the chief forester there wrote me and said it's bringing premium prices. I've made some planting, found out how fast they grow, and I planted more, and more and more. You stick an 8-inch cutting in wet soil in February. In October, you got a tree from 4 to 6 feet high. Then in 4 years, 45 feet average height.
4 years?
And the first tree I planted is now 11 years old. It's over 75 feet high. And tree that'll grow that fast, that's what I told him. Well, I don't know what it's good for, but a tree that grows that fast may have a use. And we got lots of wet land in Florida.
Yeah.
Now the report is 100,000 acres are going to be planted in the South. Pioneering. You know the old saying? You seldom hear about a man being ahead of his time until he's dead.
Yeah,
and no longer a threat to those who've been behind in theirs. A lot of truth in that.
You know that threat, you know, I never realized that, but that threat is really, that's real. It's real, isn't it?
What is?
The threat.
The threat, yes, yeah. It's very real.
Very real.
You know, those who have been threatened, they're angry about it. They're mad at you.
Yes, sir. And you lay that like you
know
me, about
it. I'm not supposed to know anything. And that galls me.
Well, they're not.
But most of them.
When you say wetland, you don't necessarily mean a swamp, though.
Well,
now this is a nice narrative. Nice, sustained narrative. It's just beautiful. I didn't realize we lit out on his main subject so early. I don't remember just where we were standing. This other gentleman was with us, so he had an audience. It wasn't just me. No, I don't remember that. See, we talk so much and tape so much, I can't recapture where we stood. But see, I led him into it. What reception? And now this other gentleman leads him into wet land. That's a good subject. Oh, we must be down there at the swamp, by my swamp. I can't remember taping a tall coming down the lane.
Like that, but most of them.
When you say wetland, you don't necessarily mean a swamp, though.
Well, wetland and wetland. If the water table remains for 3 months at or near the surface, that's too wet even for cottonwoods. Willows will then take over, and elderberry growth like that.
And cypress.
But cypress, yes. And another tree that is valuable.
Old maple.
Maples. Atlantic white cedar is a high value tree. It's largely in West Florida.
That's very.
I planted in that kind of land. Just goes to town. It's a bog tree. So I have some of those also. I have some 20-some species there. Some are just on trial. Somebody will say, why didn't you plant some black locusts? Well, plant 6 or 7 of them. There they are. What do you think of them? They're not doing too well. I wouldn't plant them because
they don't
grow naturally south of central Georgia.
Oh,
they
grow naturally out here on my place.
Oh, if you have good dirt with limestone and clay under it, they'll do fair. But Florida is sand 90%.
Yeah.
And so you can't.
Well, now, what is wetland for cottonwood then? Did you tell him?
Oh, that stays moist most of the year.
Just it'll grow grass, you might say.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Moist enough to grow grass.
Oh, yes.
So, would this be cottonwood?
It'll grow fairly well up to about the edge of those tree branches there. And when it gets drier than that, it'll grow there all right, but it won't make its optimum growth.
This would be too wet out in here.
Oh, that's marsh, yes. Yeah. That would be too wet. The water table there is at or above the surface.
And you don't want to get where the water will come up over them occasionally.
It's a funny thing. I've observed that. You know, if you're in the woods for 56 years, 58 now, the way I have been, and keep your eyes open, you learn a few things that are important, and they're not in the book.
Yeah.
The cottonwood will stand any amount of flooding.
Oh, they will.
If the water moves.
Oh.
Standing water, oh no.
Yeah.
That's different.
But now you see, when I came out here, there was a rim of dead trees along there.
Oh, yeah.
And I got tired looking at them, so
periodically the water table gets extraordinarily high. Maybe it'll take 70 years, but it'll finally get above its normal.
And since I've been out here, it's been up in the edge of the woods, too. So another fringe of them died.
Yeah. Well, nature's always spreading, spreading, spreading. And find land birds, when I was in the Navy, World War One, found land birds out 500 miles out to sea. Nature trying to find new islands, new places for them. Finally, they drop in the water dead. They can't stay there forever. One little old tillyhawk landed on our mast one time, way out there, several hundred miles. And I said, well, he's lost. He flew off, and he caught one of those little sea swallows and flew back on the nest and started picking the
trash. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right out in the middle of the ocean.
To make it back. See, you can't. They do have to rest.
How'd he get out there then?
Well, probably by ships.
And he'd go back by ships.
And he might get back by ships. You know. Chances are he wouldn't. Chances are he'd become exhausted before he got another ship and fall.
Well, you all didn't bother him.
Huh?
You all didn't bother him.
Because they will spread out and die back, and spread out and die back. I saw between Pulaski and Gainesville one time, we had an extraordinary long, high water table in the lake, and longleaf pine won't stand much wet feet, and the water got up so high it killed 75-year-old trees.
Oh.
There were 75 before years since that water got that high. So there's a lot to see if you see what you're looking at.
Yeah, if you look what you see what you're looking at.
That's an old homeless saying by myself, but I know there's a lot of truth in it. But learning is a lifetime process.
I don't think that's a homeless saying, Mr. Needham.
It's a what? A homeless?
Yeah.
Well,
no, that's an expert. It takes an expert to say that.
Well, yes, I guess not too many people understand what you mean when you say it.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Now, this is the end of this reel. This is the end of Channel 2 Over. The end of Channel 2 Over. I'm copying now the cassette of Mr. Nealon. The Audubon visit on Saturday, the 11th of October, 69. This is a cassette that I took in the field as we went around to the back pasture and back by the West Hammock. On the Audubon visit on Saturday the 11th of October, 69, this is the end of Channel 2 Over and the end of this reel. That's the end of this reel. This is a reel, Louis Nealon 1. I'm copying the cassette made in the field. Louis Nealon, Saturday, the Audubon visit, Saturday the 11th of October, 69. This is the end of this reel, the end of Channel 2 Over.